All right, glad to see everybody tonight. Does anybody need an outline? So we are in Genesis chapter 1. I had the normal outline last week, and then I had a second paper. We didn't get to that. We were talking about the atmosphere and things of this nature. So I wanted to just hit that real quickly. There's still some back there on that table if you didn't get one. So let's talk about probability for just a minute. And what we were talking about last week, Genesis 1, verses 6 through 8, you have the firmament, the expanse, atmosphere, planetary surface temperatures tend to get colder the farther a planet is from the sun. Venus is the exception, as its proximity to the sun and its dense atmosphere make it our solar system's hottest planet. The mean temperatures of planets in our solar system are as follows. Mercury, 333 degrees Fahrenheit. Venus, 867. Earth, 59 degrees. Mars, minus 85. Now, there are some places on Earth that get, at times in the year, around 100 below zero. Mars' average temperature is negative 85. Jupiter, negative 166. Saturn, negative 220. Uranus, minus 320. Neptune, so it just gets colder and colder as you go. So what is the probability of life existing on any of those planets with that being the case, with those temperatures being the case? Ranging from, well, think about it like this. So if Mercury, well, let's take Venus, 867 degrees, and then go all the way down to what they call the dwarf planet Pluto, minus 375. So what's the difference there, Jay? 867, 370, that's about 1,200 degrees. Approximately, that is a massive difference. What is the probability of life? I mean, we've been searching for decades, haven't we? For life on other planets? I'd say it's probably pretty low. Like I said, there are parts of our planet that get down to in the double-digit negatives, and sometimes even triple digits, rarely. You're not going to find life anywhere else. How likely is it that in the process of the Big Bang, the expansion of the universe, the constant movement of the universe around the sun, that all of this just happened by time and chance. And the laws of gravity and the laws of reproduction, which we're going to talk about somewhat tonight, all of that is just perfect on one planet. And it, you know, hey, time and chance, it just happened that way. There are actually people who have done, I don't know what you exactly would call it, but they've done the numbers, and the likelihood of things just happening as a result of some uncaused explosion billions of years ago, I guess I would just say it like this. It didn't happen. Didn't happen. There's no way to explain the order and the function and the ability to inhabit this particular planet as opposed to everything else in the universe, and no intelligent design, no mind behind the processes that took place in creation and what we see now. So, anyway, like I said, that you don't have to get that, but I thought it was something interesting. I printed off a few copies of that last week. All right, Genesis chapter 1. Somebody read verses 9 to 13 for us, please. All right. The United States Geological Survey says from about 300 to 200 million years ago, the late Paleozoic era until the late Triassic, the continent we know as North America was contiguous with Africa, South America, and Europe. They all existed as a single planet called Pangaea. So I brought that up in the end of last week's class. I'll put a map up there. This is what we are told that the Earth originally looked like. And it's pretty interesting, actually, because when you look at, well, when you look at that, it does look like you can move things around and piece it back together, doesn't it? And I think we'll talk about that when we discuss Genesis 6 and the flood, too, because a lot happened with the tectonic plates, with the crust of the earth. A lot happened in the Noahic flood, but there's nothing to say that at one point in time that the earth looked like this. Because what Sarah just read to us, notice again in verse 9, how were the waters gathered together? What does it say? Into what? One place. All right, now, if you look at Pangaea, you got it in one place. However, when you look at this map, the water's all connected too. And so in essence, the water, four or five oceans that we have, the water still meets everywhere. And so you could say technically, the waters were gathered together in one place in that format. We are told, though, and so here's the key to understanding the evolutionary mindset. There's a phrase, the present is the what? What do they say about evolution? The present is the key to the past. Y'all ever heard that? The present is the key to the past? The way it looks now is the way it looked then, and we can gauge how things happen because there have been no real catastrophes. And again, so in the context of the book of Genesis, one of those catastrophes would be the Noahic flood. I mentioned the word last week, uniformitarianism. Everything has stayed uniform for them. So anyway, we are told that Pangaea broke up about 194 million years before the first ancestors of humans were on Earth. And we are told that the breakup process took, and this is your first blank, I believe, 30 to 120 million years. I looked up the numbers. I didn't write them down, so I don't remember precisely. If one of you wants to Google it real quick, do that for us. How quickly or how much are the continents drifting? It was something like 4 centimeters. I want to say maybe per year. I don't know if that's right, though. But I remember the measurement was like 4 centimeters. So if the present is the key to the past, and if you're moving at 4 centimeters per year, I mean, how much is 4 centimeters? What's the conversion rate of centimeters to inches? Anybody know? It's not 4 centimeters is not much. We'll just say that. That would take a long time to move from that to that. No question about it. Now, 1.5 centimeters a year. So anywhere from 1 to 10. Thanks, guys. No. It's a rather minuscule amount, isn't it? Very small amount that it moves per year. Okay, thank you. 4 centimeters, about 1/4 inch. That is not much. I mean, think about the size of the earth, the size of the continents, and you're talking 1/4 inch a year? Yeah. How do they determine that? That's a legitimate. I mean, how, why? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. How long would it take you to fly from, say, New York City to somewhere in Europe at 700 miles an hour? That's a long flight, isn't it? Well, look at Australia down here and Antarctica. And then look at how far they are spread out as compared to everything else, like Africa, for instance. It's science. Trust the science, guys. The natural drift of the plates. Tectonic plates. And, well, again, so if we And this, for our purposes of biblical study, when you mythologize Genesis 1 through 11, you make the story of Noah's flood a myth, an allegory, a spiritual poem. But that didn't happen from that perspective. And so there's no major catastrophe that would cause continental drift to such an extreme as that might have. And like I said, we'll cover that in Genesis 6 because there are some pretty interesting things in that text that help us out. Okay, so we're told the breakup took anywhere from 30 to 120 million years. Well, 90 million years, that's not a small amount of time. And so when we get into these numbers, there are massive gaps like that, not 30 to 120 million years. Well, how do you know that's like, Steve, how do you know that? Who's taking the measurements? And when did they start measuring it? When did they start measuring? You know, I don't know. Yes, the present is the key to the past. Well, and if there was a catastrophic event, like a worldwide flood, where Scripture tells us the great fountains of the deep are opened up, that's going to have a massive effect on land masses. You think about what earthquakes and volcanoes can even do on a local scale, you know, and even erosion on a local scale can have a major, you know, localized flooding. What are they called out when they go out in the desert? Flash flooding. Canyons, obviously not a Grand Canyon, but they can be created within a matter of days. Yeah. Well, and then, so expand that out to 5 billion years. I mean, that's something to think about. All right, next bullet point here. So, let's see, what did we read here? Where did you stop, Sarah? Okay. All right, somebody go ahead and read verses 11 to 13, please. Wait a second. I had another slide, I'm sorry. In terms of continental drift. Now, okay, so let's go back to Pangaea for just a minute. This idea that everything was one landmass. All right? It is not unreasonable to believe that. Let me say that. Again, it's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle when you look at the pieces. Just be honest about it. But another thing is the fossil record shows that in certain parts of each of these continents, the same animals were there. And it's like you can trace where they were. And if you line those continents up, the lines match where those fossils are being found. Okay? So, well, how did they get there? How did they leave one continent? Okay, how did they leave South America here, heading, what would that be, northeast, and end up in Africa at essentially the same location, directionally? So, it's not crazy to believe that. I just wanted to say that. Any questions or comments on that? Well, I remember studying it in school too, that you and not only fossils, but the strata, the layers of sediment in the earth match up in those essentially those same locations. Okay? Science, here's the thing, because the picture is often painted that if you're religious, you don't believe in science, right? You're antiquated, you don't believe in science, you just, you know, you take everything on faith. The thing is, when you, true religion has no problem with true science. That's the thing. Now, false science, that's a whole other story. Okay, evolution, that's not true science. It's taught that way. But there are so many gaps in that belief system that it's not even funny. But there's no problem in believing this. The record's there. Why try to deny it? Okay. Now, go ahead. Whoever, Ashlyn, was that you? Go ahead and read there. 11 to 13. Okay, so, kind. Each according to its kind. The word, from what I understand in my studies, kind, we sometimes want to supplement the word species for kind. And that's not an accurate, that's not a parallel translation. Those are not exactly the same thing. So let's think about that for just a minute. according to its kind. So a kind, and I guess we could even say a species, these are populations, here's your next blank, that can interbreed. All right, so are y'all familiar with this? I am not a farmer, never have been, don't pretend to be. Populations that can interbreed. Give me some examples. What am I talking about here? Help me out. Any of you have cows or anything? Cows. Okay, there are all kinds. There are all kinds of, what would be the word to describe the variety of cows? Breeds. But can they interbreed? They're bovine, right? They can interbreed. And by the way, so these are populations that can interbreed and still maintain, your next blank, variation. Okay? Again, true. Believing in the creation account and what is taught here. Now, this is the vegetation kingdom, obviously. Grass, herb-yielding seed, and the tree yielding fruit. So we're not to animals yet. We're just making a point here. Populations that can interbreed and still maintain variation. Yes, but tomatoes never become apples. As far as I know, Ken, have you ever had any tomato plants produce pears? If you do, call me, because I like pears. So evolution tells us, essentially, now we'll get to that in a minute. Evolution tells us, essentially, that things started out in the oceans. Now, how does that compare with what Scripture says where life began? Verse 11, grass, herb-yielding fruit, trees, etc. The biblical record tells us it's not until day six that sea creatures begin to come forth. Is that right? Is it day five? Yeah, birds and fish, day five, that's right. I haven't sung that song in a long time. Evolution says it's fish to amphibians to reptiles to mammals to human that we all essentially, not essentially, that we all have the same common ancestor. But the fact of the matter is this, change in the biological world has limits. It's your next blank. Change in the biological world has limits. Let's see. Again, okay, the tomatoes to apples. There are limits to what tomato plants can do. Watermelons, cows, horses, sheep, you name it. Cats, dogs. Dogs and cats cannot, you can't crossbreed those. As far as I know, again, I'm not a farmer or a biologist or anything like that, but you're not going to have those things because biology has its limits. There are biological limits in the world. So God created fully matured vegetation. And see, that's the thing. When you look at verse 11 there, look at it again. Let the earth bring forth grass and herb yielding seed and the fruit tree yielding fruit. One of the arguments for an ancient earth is apparent age. The earth looks old. All right, so somebody tell me, what does 4.6 billion look like? Anybody care to? As opposed to, let's say, 2 billion. What's the difference in appearance? That's one of the arguments of evolution is apparent age. But we're told here in God's creative order that when He created these things, they had their seed within them, which means they were mature. They were able to what? Reproduce. Bear fruit. Yes, the chicken did come first. The chicken came first, that's right. Right, okay, good. Oh, all right, so you said it. How? 5 seconds. 5 seconds. Let's give him 10 seconds. 10 seconds after Adam was created, Mr. Keith, how old was he? Bingo. If we accept what Scripture says about the creation account, He had apparent age, but he was miraculously created by God. God created fully matured vegetation that possessed the ability to reproduce. There's your next blank. Reproduce. These had the apparent age on the day they were created. All right? Evolution demands an ancient earth. There's your last blank in that section. Evolution demands an ancient earth. And that's where I ask that question. Well, what does 4.6 billion years look like? As opposed to, what are some of these other numbers? 300 million, you know, talking about Pangaea. What's the difference in appearance? I don't know how you'd put that on a canvas. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. What would one day old Earth look like? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, I'm talking from the evolutionary perspective. If it's 4.6 billion years old right now, what did it look like when it was one day old? From their perspective, you know? All right. Anything else before we move on here? Okay, somebody read Genesis 1. Do that whole section, 14 to 19. Okay. So let's go back to a week or two ago. We were talking about the day-age theory. So we are told here in Scripture now that on day 4, you have the light sources. And remember, I told you last week, I've read the Bible, I don't know how many times or for how many years, and I've never noticed, verse 4, God saw the light. Verse 14, God said, let there be lights. It just never clicked with me until I was really digging more and preparing for this class, but there's something to that. Yes, the lights. That's what we're getting ready to talk about. So, if on day 3, as this text says here, God created vegetation, and if vegetation's survival and reproduction is dependent upon photosynthesis, which we will talk about here, how would one explain the day-age theory? What's the day-age theory? Yeah, every day is however long they need it to be to fill up the billions of years. Yeah. How do you explain the survival of vegetation if day one is a, let's just say a billion, let's give them a billion. Day two is a billion, day three is a billion. That doesn't make that, I mean, saying it that way doesn't even sound right, does it? It doesn't even make sense. Photosynthesis. Anybody in here care to run us through that one? Or do we just want to look at the picture? I'm good with the picture, okay? So you have light energy creating chemical energy inside the plant. Of course, you have water, you have minerals in the soil, you have carbon dioxide in the air. All of this is working together. The plants themselves, of course, they have a root system, but they have veins that run up through them. They have pores. What are those called? Sporata? They're called something like that, but they breathe. Plants are living organisms, okay? Well, the sun is the source of light. Your next blank here. The sun is the source of light, and the moon is a, what is the moon in terms of light? Is it a source of light? What? It's a reflector of light, right? So, again, if the day-age theory is true, you got to explain this. And we're looking at this from the perspective of, again, there are some folks even in the Lord's church who tell us that, yes, I believe in creation, but I also believe in the Darwinian timeline of evolution. And you got to explain how vegetation survived for however many hundreds of millions of years until the light source was created. The light, yeah. Yeah. That was an interesting discussion on that. But there is a clear distinction between the light and the lights, textually. They are sources of oxygen, yes. Yeah. we'd be in trouble. How did that evolve? You know, how did those processes, how did all of that intricate, what would you say, interconnectivity evolve? Because if it messed up the first time, then you have to start all over. Right. For a reason. Let's do this real quick. Somebody turn over to Matthew 16, and I want you to read the first four verses there. So we're talking about the sun is the source of light, and the moon is a reflector of the light from the sun. I've got some pretty interesting diagrams up here in just a second. Matthew 16, 1 through 4. Okay, hold on just a second. A sign from heaven. The preposition there in the Greek is ek, and it literally means a sign out of the heavens. We want you to give us something out of the sky is what they're asking for. All right, go ahead. You can look at the sky and tell some. So you guys have heard that, what's it called? Not a cliche, but you've heard the old saying, red sky in morning, what's that? It's a sailor's fail warning. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. Comes from Scripture, seems like. You can look at the sky and determine things. So look at Genesis chapter 1 here. Somebody read verse 14 again. Day from night. Signs and seasons. Days and years. Days and years. How do we get our 24-hour day? What does it come from? The rotation of the earth. Was it like 23 point some odd hours? Where do we get our years from? Okay. Where do we get our months from? Lunar calendar. This is this month. This is next month. You can discern the face of the sky, but you can't see what's going on right in front of you, Jesus says. And all of these, so again, the moon is a, okay, that was it. Depending on where the earth is, and the sun, and by the way, what's the moon doing as the earth is both rotating and orbiting? What's the moon doing that whole time? It's all moving, isn't it? And you can look at the sky, and by the way, you can see that the earth is not flat. I saw a video of these flat earthers trying to prove their theory. And they did these measurements up and down, and I forget how far apart they were, but they knew that a light that they were shining was going to shine through all of these holes. So they did this measurement, and guess what didn't happen? The light didn't shine through all the holes. So anyway, that's just I won't charge you anything for that one. The sun is the source of light. The moon is a reflector of light from the sun. You can see it. Next bullet point here, the presence of season. What does the presence of seasons imply? See if you can fill in the blank. We talked about this a bit last week. So the earth is not on its axis, that imaginary center line is not, what would that be, 180 degrees? What is it? 23 degrees, isn't it? The earth is tilted on its axis at 23.4 degrees to be precise. It's rotating. It's orbiting. The presence of seasons implies the tilt of the earth. Your next blank. The tilt of the earth, its rotation, and its orbit around the sun. I told you last week, January, the earth is actually closer to the sun, but in the northern hemisphere, it's colder. Why? The northern half of the earth is colder. Why? It's tilted away from the sun. That's why we have however many less hours of daylight. And then you get to spring, and you've got the longest day of the year sometime in spring. Anyway, that speaks to something. The sun, moon, and stars are for days and months and years. Where does the week come from? Oh, by the way, our next full moon will be January 25th. At 12:54 Eastern Standard Time. And in February, it'll be February 24th. What question did I just ask? Yeah, where does the week come from? We know days, months, and years. Where does the week come from? From Genesis 1. 7 days in a week. Any questions or comments on all of this? That's a good question. You have to deal with that, don't you? You have to deal with the function of the universe. If you're going to make claims like, and again, it's a creation compromise. I meant to bring some books in here just to show you some, if you want to do some extra reading, you're an extra good student, I've got some books I would recommend. There are a lot of things that cannot be accounted for if you hold on to things like the day-age theory, the evolutionary timetable, even the geologic timetable. The light was separated from the darkness there on day one, but you don't have the light sources until day four. There was some source of light, but it wasn't the current sources of light that we know were created on day four. But yeah, the first 3 days, there were evening and morning. So when you find out, you let me know. No, nothing different from... And this is way off subject, but that kind of speaks to the reliability of English translations. Jesus himself... Here's the thing. Well, I did a sermon here 3 or 4 years ago. It's on our YouTube channel on Bible translations. People want a literal translation. No, you don't. You don't have a literal translation. What I mean by literal is you take one Hebrew word, you have one English word, one Hebrew word. That is not how translation in any language works. And so many people don't understand that. So I've got a lot of material on all that stuff, but yeah. All right, guys. I was going to talk a little bit about constellations because the Bible speaks a lot of constellations. Just another interesting topic. Scripture is not anti-science. It's not. All right, guys. Thank you.